Forgive me sitting upon this stool. This is a new gimmick that is used by artists these days. The idea, of course, is to give an impression of relaxation. It is what is known in my profession as the Dave Allen myth. If an actor doesn't know what to do with his hands, he has a walking stick. If he doesn't know what to do with his mouth, he has a cigarette. I have a stool. Now, my name is John Pertwee, which it isn't. Not truly. My real name is Jean de Pertuis de Layevaux, and I hope you're very impressed. I come from a long line that my mother should never have listened to, a French line of Huguenots. The majority of my family was, in fact, Catholic in France in 1865, and they pushed out the Protestants. And there was one Protestant, a man called Georges de Pertuis de Layevaux, and he came and he moved into Suffolk. And the large Pertuis clan, as it's known today, is the result of his personal athleticism. And nobody could pronounce the name properly, Pertuis, Pertuis de Layevaux, P-E-R-T-H-U-I-S. They couldn't pronounce it, so the illiterate English pronounced it Pertwis. So it was duly changed to P-E-R-T-W-E. As with the result, as they called it, Pee-wee, etc., etc. Now, I have here in my autobiography, Moon Boots and Dinner Suits, which you can't buy any longer, it's out of print. It says, due to the inability to pronounce the name Pertwee, other than Pertwis, it was changed to Pertwee. This proved a pointless exercise, as over the years, even in England, I have been subjected to the following interpretations of my name, the veracity of which I swear to, having avidly filed them away over the years. And here's a list of them. Tom Peatweet, John Peartree, Mr. Twee, Mr. Bert Wee, which I like, John Peewee, Miss Jane Partwick, Master J. Peewit, Mr. Petweek, Joan Pestwick, J. Pertiny, John Between, I like that, and Mr. and Mrs. John Perky. And when I was in America, I was working on Broadway, and I used to walk down Broadway, and I looked up, and there it was, John Pertwee, and I was so proud of the fact my name was in lights. And after 6 months, I walked into the theatre one day, and there was the stage doorkeeper sitting at the end of the passage, smoking his big stogie, and he said, "Hey, John." And I paid no attention, of course, my name not being Jan, and I walked on merrily into the theatre. And he said, "Hey, Jan." And I said, "Who, me?" He said, "Yeah, Jan Putrid, it's a letter for you." So from that moment onwards in America, I was always known as Jan Putrid, which I suppose is better than when I was standing outside Grosvenor House many years ago, somebody came up to me and said, "Excuse me, but weren't you John Pertwee?" That's nice, isn't it? Weren't you, John Pertwee? And a lady, this is an extraordinary story. It's not that funny, but it's an extraordinary story. There's a lady, and she came up to me when I was with a great dear friend of mine, and she said, "Excuse me, but aren't you Helen Twelve Trees?" And I said, "Helen Twelve Trees is a very elderly character actress." And she said, "That's right." That's true. On another occasion, I remember getting into a train. I was going to see a Doctor Who conference, and I usually wear the sort of Doctor Who gear when I go to these conferences, and I had my Doctor Who cape on. And I tried to find somewhere in this train that was empty, and the whole train was absolutely full. And I walked up, and there was a compartment that was empty, but it had a little label stuck in the window. It said, "This compartment is reserved for people from St. Thomas's Hospital." And so I thought, there's nobody there, so I'll go in. And I sat down, and just as the train was leaving, the door opened, and in came two men in white coats with a collection of people, all a bit doolally-taps. They all sat down very happily, and the nurse thought he'd count everybody up and check them all out, and he said, "Right, now let's have you, and let's have a little count here. Now then, one, two..." And he looked at me, he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Doctor Who." He said, "Four, five, six..." Anyway, as I was telling you, I come from a long theatrical family. My father was Roland Pertwee. He was an eminent playwright, and some of you may remember, as a writer. He was a scenarist. He worked a lot in Hollywood and in England writing movies. My uncle Guy He looked after me when I was very little because my father and mother split up when I was tiny. My mother took one look at me and went, "Ooh, no," and she left. And so my granny looked after me. And my Uncle Guy, too. Guys, look here, Mother. Most important thing, he taught elocution as a lesson. He was the professor of the Guildhall School of Music and Drama at the Guildhall, and he taught elocution. Extraordinary how he managed. He was the only man I ever knew who had a motor car, and he didn't change gear to go uphill. He leant forward slowly. Uncle Guy. My grandmother was an opera singer. She had the sort of voice that you use to augment grief at funerals. Lovely voice, though, she had. Dame Eva Moore, her daughter was Jill Esmond, and Jill Esmond married Laurence Olivier, the world's greatest actor, in my opinion, it was. And let me give you an example of why I say that. He was very shy in many ways. He didn't like people approaching him from the back. Understandable in some ways, but he did from the front, fine. The back, no, no. And we went to a party once. And I said, "Come on, Larry, we're going to this lovely party." He said, no, I'd really rather." I said, "Yes, you're going." He said, I said, "Yes, you're going." So we took him and we put him on a sofa and we gave him drink and a sandwich. And we said, "No, you'll be all right." And he started to relax when an elderly lady came up behind him and she clapped her hands over his eyes and she said, "Guess who?" And that's exactly the sort of thing he hated. So he went, and the lady fell backwards and she fell against the settee behind and she went AOT over the settee with the legs in the air, with the black bombazine knicker well to the fore. And he paid no attention to it at all. And he went over to his host and he said, "Who is that old woman?" He said, "Oh, that's my mother-in-law." He said, "Isn't she marvellous?" Doesn't that prove to you that's the world's greatest actor? Well, anyway, we all used to forgather in our house in London and we used to do plays at Christmas. All the family, all the aunts, my godfather and my uncle, they were silent screen stars and so on. So we did wonderful plays in the sitting room. We had a niche in the sitting room by a bay window with a roller blind at the back. And we used to do plays in this niche. And the extraordinary thing was the very first play that I ever did was in that niche, working with these eminent people of the theatre. And when my daughter Dariel, who's now an actor, when she made her first appearance on a stage, the house that I was brought up in had been turned into a nursery school, and she went to this nursery school, and you would never believe it, but I've got a movie of her doing her first play as a tiny mite in the niche that I did my first play in. Wasn't that an extraordinary thing? That's true. My father had just come back from Hollywood. He'd been working over there as a scenarist, and he'd been having a lot of fun at William Randolph Hearst's ranch, San Simeon. You know, you've seen all about that when you saw the film Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. And he used to invite just a few guests to spend the weekend with him, like 250 people, something of that nature. And he would sit at one end of the dinner table. His mistress, Marion Davis, the silent screen star, would sit at the other end of the table, which was about as long as from here to the end of the theatre, which was a very intimate gathering of friends. Amazing people used to go there, and I've got a movie, actually, of my father getting into the swimming pool on the shoulders of Buster Keaton, and Buster Keaton went down the steps with my father on his shoulder, and he walked the whole length of the swimming pool and up the other side with my father, and never paused for breath. It's the most extraordinary thing. I mean, they're very strange people, very, very odd. I must tell you, this particular day, they had a very unusual thing happen. They had a lot of nubile young ladies who decided to go topless. Horrors. I mean, in those days, can you believe it? I mean, we're talking about the early 30s. Topless ladies in swimming pools. Well, my father, funnily enough, had a movie camera with him. And so he said, "This is an opportunity not to be missed. We must show it for the Christmas show when I get back home." And so he filmed the show in the swimming pool at San Simeon. And when we got back for Christmas, he just said, "I'm going to show you a marvellous little show now. Nubile topless ladies." And, "Ooh." And the only place we could show it was the niche on the roller blind. And he showed it, and it was sort of successful. The uncles and Larry Olivier and everybody, "Hooray!" And the aunts. You know, not many people. But it was an enormous success with the 300 people outside in the street who'd seen it on the roller blind. Anyway, my father married again. He married a lady called Dorothy. I didn't care for her at all. She was the sort of proverbial stepmother as far as I was concerned. And so when they went down to Devonshire to live, we had a house on the River Exe down in Dulverton, near Tiverton. It was a great life, really, for a boy. We had a farm, and we had horses for hunting. We had the house on the top of a hill, and the farm was below.
Mr. and Mrs. Brumfield run the farm, and they had a regiment of children. That is a mass production system. And Mrs. Brumfield and he, they'd be collecting the carrots or something, you see. And she'd say, "Excuse me, my dear, I've just got to pop into the house for a minute, have the child, and I'll be back in a moment." And she'd go back to the house and plop, she'd have the baby. And she'd come back to the house, "Oh, well, there you are, dear, you've got another little daughter." I said, "Now, where'd you put them carrots?" And they'd be off again. An amazing couple of people, the Brumfields. And they looked after the farm with the horses, and our house was up on top of the hill. And the postman used to come. And he used to deliver letters for miles around to the farms. He'd walk the equivalent of 4 times round the world in gumboots. So you can imagine the condition of his feet. On his way in, he used to call into the pubs, you see, and have a few pints of scrumpy. And so by the time he got to our house, he'd had a few, you see. And he used to look up at the house on the top of the hill, and he'd look and he'd say, "Oh, poor, I ain't going up there. Boy, no, I ain't going up there. Let them young bastards come down and get it." And with that, he'd take the letters and he'd throw them over the gate into the field, into the mud. And my father, who'd be looking through his binoculars, said, "Good God, the damn man's done it again." And he said, "Go on, boys." He said, "Down you go, a penny each to each collecting the mail and bringing it up." And so we ran down and said, "Right, oh, Dad." And we got a hold of him, Mr. Willicombe. And we said, "Here, Mr. Willicombe, would you mind throwing the letters in the mud every day? Because, you see, if we pick them up out of the mud, we get a penny each, you see." So we did a deal. And he said, "Oh, cool, yeah, I'll plan then," and you throw it in the mud and we go down and get it and get the threepence. Now, he'd had a rather too many scrumpies and he wasn't too fit. So they got another postman and they hauled him out of retirement. And he was extremely old. He was 83. And he had his old hat that he'd been using. It one of them four peak and half hats. Do you remember? Anybody remember him? The little postman's hat, the little thing, the hard hat. Well, his name was Park Curtis, and he was over 80, and he had eyebrows that stuck up there like that. And Park Curtis said, "Coral," he said, "I'm going to be the fastest postman in the West Country," he said. "Don't worry about that," he said. "I'm going to be faster than Willicombe in his gumboots. I get a bike." And he bought a racing bike. 83 years of age, he bought a racing bike with bent handlebars and a very hard saddle. And he used to deliver the letters at enormous speed. And one day he disappeared. We couldn't find him anywhere. And I said, "Where's Park Curtis?" They said, "Haven't you heard?" "Oh," he said, "he's had a terrible accident." He said, "He was going up Studley Hill," he said, "against the wind." He said, "His head down, his ass in the air, pedalling away up the hill." He said, "And he'd been down so far, he got his eyebrows caught in the front spokes." He said, "Hand him off, quick as a trice," he said. He said, "He's in the hospital." And so I went to see him, and I said, "Pa, what have you done?" "Well," he said, I was going too fast," he said, "Master John, too fast." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you something, Pa, I'll give you a good bit of news." I said, "I've just put on the air, on a radio show, I've got a postman, and I call him Postman Curtis." And I said, "And it's all based on you, so when you listen and you hear an old man say, well, what does it matter what you do? So long as you tear him up. That's you." Do you remember that character? Yeah, a long time ago. Waterlogged Spa with Eric Barker. And that was based on old Park Curtis. Now, we used to have horses. I told you, we used to go hunting. The Devon and Somerset Staghounds or the Tiverton Staghounds. Now, I used to hunt on a little tiny Shetland pony called Shadow. And you went to the meet. You had to hack to the meet. Very exhausting. And then for the rest of the day, you'd be hunting. Even more exhausting. When you wanted to get home, he was keen to go home. It was like riding a vibrator, I'm telling you. It was an awful experience. The soles of my feet were worn out from scraping along the road. And so I said, "Well, the only thing to do, I have to buy another horse." And my father said, "Well, go to Bampton Fair." He said, "If you go there, you can get one for 5 shillings.
5 bob, that's true, and I bought my first good hunting pony, an Exmoor pony, for 5 shillings. I remember I went to the man that I bought it from, and I said, excuse me, sir.
He said, yes.
I said, I bought this horse from you. He said, yes. And I said, how do I get it home? He said,
you bought it, I don't give a bugger how you get it home. Put a bit of rope round his neck, he said, and tow him, and I did. We towed it in a car.
We towed it all the way back, we're leaping up and down, but we got it home and it made a very fine hunting pony. One of the masters of the Devon and Somerset staghounds was a Colonel Lucien Gore, a great First World War hero. He had lost the sight of one eye, had a black patch, and he'd lost an arm in the same action, and he lost a leg. So he had only one leg and one arm and a black patch. And his groom, Torsten, he used to strap him for the day onto the horse, because he couldn't hold on with one leg, you see, it was very difficult with one arm. And, of course, naturally, halfway through the day, he'd get taken short. And he'd say, Johnson, come on. He said, behind the hedge, up. He said, yes, sir. And they went behind a thicket, you see, and he said, right, anybody about? He said, no, sir. He said, right, then, come on. And so Torsten undid the flap of the colonel's riding breeches, and he put the hand in to get the naughty bits out, you see, and over the side he would go and relieve himself. And perfectly normal, understandable. And he said, right, old Torsten, come up, back, come up, up, come up. And that would go, and he'd do him up, and away he'd go. Well, this particular day, he said, Torsten, come up, come up. And behind the figure here, behind, come on, man, come on, quick, 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 quick. And so Torsten said, yes, sir. And he went there, and he undid the flap, and he put the hand in. He said, come on, man, hurry up.
He said, I'm being as quick as I can, sir.
He said, what's the matter? What's the trouble, man?
He said, I'm very sorry, sir. He said, I can't find it.
He said, can't find it? Good God, man, you had it last. Now, Colonel Lucien Gore, wonderful man. Wonderful man. Great days of hunting, those were. Great days, real days. While I was there, I was rather unhappy at home, so I decided that I'd do what everybody does. And a lot of kids that are unhappy at home, they sort of run away and join a circus. And actually, there was one to join. Lord John Sanger, his name was. It was a great circus that toured the West Country. So I rushed off, and I went to see Lord John Sanger, and I said, excuse me, my lord, have you by any chance got a job you could give me in your circus during my holidays?
And he said, well, I don't know, lad. What can you do?
Yeah, a real lord, obviously. You know. He said,
What can you do, lad?
And I said, well, I can't do anything, actually.
He said, well, it's not much bloody good to me, is it? Can't do nothing. Wait a minute, he said, oh, I got it, yes. You came on a motorbike, didn't you?
And I said, yes, I did.
He said, right then, go and see Captain Arthur Overland. He said, and tell him I sent you and ask for a job.
I said, what does he do? He said, he rides the Wall of Death. Ah, yeah, now you know what the Wall of Death is, don't you? It's a great, big, enormous cup of wood, almost as big as this theatre, and you ride motorbikes round inside it, up and down and up and down, and you sit sideways and you do all sorts of showing. Actually, it's very easy because it's just like going uphill all the time, rather quickly uphill. Don't look to the right, you get giddy and you throw up over your audience, so don't. It's not a very good idea. Anyway, I went there, and to begin with, I just sat in the leathers on the side of the Indian motorbikes, and I go, you know, as they do with the... Do you remember, any of you, that magnificent sensation, the smell of castor? Ah. Ah. Oh, you do know what I mean. Those of you that don't, it's like Chanel No. 5 to a man. The smell of castor ah was marvellous, and I used to make all these wonderful smells, and everybody would go, like Bisto ads, you know. And then they would go in and watch the Wall of Death. Well, one day a fella came up to me and he said, here, John, can I have a word? So I said, yes. He said, would you like to buy a lion? I said, what? He said, would you like to buy a lion? He said, because we've got Leo, you see, and he's no bloody good to us, he said. He's just stole his teeth. He said, he don't frighten nobody. He goes, He said, that's useless for us, he said. He said, well, I thought with that little baby Austin that you use for going around for the publicity, putting up the posters and things, I thought what a good idea for you to get the lion in the back of the baby Austin and ride him round the Wall of Death. Take a lion round the Wall of Death? Are you out of your mind? No, he said, it's a bloody good idea. He said, you'll be the only one doing it. So I had a word with Leo, and he agreed, and so we taught him to go round the wall of death on the back of a baby Austin. We strapped his face together so he went... because it'd be no good going... people seeing the gums. Unfortunately, though, Leo died in the wall of death. Try getting a 2-ton lion, a dead one, out of a wall of death. Very difficult it was, I'm telling you. I've had a hernia ever since. You know. Now, of course, during this period of time, I was at school. Not for very long at any school. That's the story of my life, really. I was expelled from everything. I went to a school called Aldrow at Eastbourne. And I'd just been to see a Tarzan film. And so when, one day, I was sitting in the lavatory lines, and there were lots of little loos, you know, little loos about this big, all in a line. There were no walls or doors or anything like that. I never quite understood why, not then anyway, but I understand now. And there they were, lines of little loos with chains above them. And I'd just been to see a Tarzan film. And I looked up and I saw all these chains and I thought, yeah, great. And so I leapt hold of the first chain. And I swung, and I swung on chain 2 and made it. And I swung on chain 3 and I fell right into the loo with my leg jammed in the U-pipe. And they had to get a plumber. And the plumber took hours to get me out. And the headmaster was standing there doing this. I cannot believe this. The effrontery of this boy. How dare you behave like that? Go and change into your gym shorts and get into the quad. I'm going to thrash you. And so I went into the quad and I received 6 of the best from the headmaster. He couldn't stand up to this heinous villain. I was 7½ years of age. 7½ years of age and was beaten and thrashed for swinging on a lavatory chain. Still, I had great fun. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I went to another school after that, which I enjoyed. It was a headmaster called P.C. Underhill. He weighed about 22 stone, an ex-rowing blue. He didn't beat you with a cane, he beat you with a fives bat. So with 22 stone behind him, when he hit you with the five bat, your head went straight through the wall opposite. But the extraordinary thing was I liked him. I liked him. Through my life, I've sort of liked the most extraordinary people. People who are fierce and supposed to be bad and supposed to be angry and supposed to frighten you, and they don't. And I liked him. I wasn't expelled from there. I went to Sherborne Public School after that. Hated that. Hated the whole system of fagging. Hated everybody in it. There were 2 guys that were bullies, and they used to destroy things that I'd made for my parents. And they used to strap me into my bed at night at the last day of term and tar and feather me. They're really good laughs, you know. I really enjoyed it, I tell you. It was wonderful. And they put me in a basket and put tuck boxes on top of it, and I'd be in there for 2-3 hours, you know. Very good for a little boy, very good. When they left, I sent them letters, and I said, you think you've got away with that, but you haven't. I'll get you yet. Watch out, I'll get you, I'll have my revenge. And I signed it, The Black Hand. Can you imagine a more stupid thing to do, to say, sending letters to 2 bully boys and saying, I'll get you yet, The Black Hand. Now, the extraordinary thing was that years and years and years later, when I was a very fit young sailor in submarines and very, very good condition, I was going up to the Café Royal to have a drink at Harry's Bar. And while I was walking up there with the 6 of my lower deck mates, across the other side of the road, I saw Brown, one of the 2 bullies. And I went, ho, ho, ho. Ho, 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 ho. And he crossed the road and he went into Harry's Bar. And that's where we went. And I went in and I said to him, excuse me. He said, yes. I said, do you remember me? And he said, no, I don't think so. I said, that's good, and hit him. And I knocked 3 of his teeth out and I knocked him right off the bar stool. And it took my 4 or 5 mates about 20 minutes to get me off him. They didn't try very hard, but they... So I said, now listen, now you remember me, don't you? I told you I'd get you. I'm the Black Hand. You tell your friend Roberts the same thing's going to happen to him if ever I see him about. You never believe it. I mean, this is a ridiculous story. But exactly a month later, I was on leave again with the same bunch of lads. And we were going down to the tea dance at the Piccadilly Hotel. And walking past Simpson's up the other way was the other one. And I said, oh, ho, ho, ho. And my mate said, oh, Christ, not again. And I said, yes, follow me. And we chased him and we ran him all the way down Lower Regent Street and we ran him through the park and we ran him into the ground. And I was just about to pounce on him when he tripped and he fell.
And so we rushed up to grab him, to pull him up, and two old ladies said, "Oh, they're nice, those sailors, aren't they?" Do you see that poor fella? He fell over, and that sailor leapt up, and he helped him up. Wasn't that nice, is it? Well, it's damn all I could do after that. And so he said, "Remember, the Black Hand will get you yet." I never saw them again, ever. That was Sherburn. I was expelled from Sherburn because I did a great and original thing which went into the history books. I beat my fag master. Instead of him beating me, I beat him. And my father decided the best thing to do was to superannuate me and remove me and send me to another school. I went to a co-educational school with girls. What a splendid arrangement. I did enjoy myself. I built an open-air theatre there. I learned languages there. I had a marvellous time. A wonderful life. Frensham Heights. I thoroughly recommend it. A great house and a great, great school. I rode a motorbike there once, and I drove it straight into a wall within 15 minutes of buying it. As I hit the wall, I went over the wall and hit in the middle of a tea party. And somebody said, "Oh, hello, you're late." That was a wonderful, original life. And this man very kindly picked me up and he took me back to the school because I was rather a mess. And there was a bit of bone sticking out of my finger, still does. He said to the headmaster, the foot chap, he was riding his bicycle down the hill and it came unstuck and he ran into a wall. "Oh," the headmaster said, "what bad luck. Thank you so much for bringing him back." I left at the end of term and we all lined up to say goodbye to the headmaster, and I got to him and he said, "Well, goodbye, John. Very nice to have had the opportunity of knowing you. There is one thing I would like to say," he said, "for God's sake, do be more careful on that motorbike," which I thought showed that he was a really first-class teacher, and he knew all along that I'd had a motorbike and that I'd run into it. The very strange thing is when I took Sean to Pierpont School, which was his school just around the corner, just as we were driving by for the first day up to his house where he was living, I said, "Stop. I know this corner." He said, "No, you don't." I said, "Yes, I do, stop." And we got out of the car and we went over to this flint wall, and there was a bit of flint and brick knocked out where my motorcycle had hit it. And I said, "That's where I had tea." And Sean said, "Are you putting me on?" I said, "No, that's the very place. That's still there. It still needs repairing after all those years." I left school. I decided the best thing I was doing was going to the theatre. Everybody else in my family had been in the theatre, of course. And so I decided that I'd try to get into a dramatic school. And I said, "I'll go to the Central School where Laurence Olivier had gone with Elsie Fogarty." And I went to see her for an audition piece and a test. And she said, "Oh, I'll come in, dear." She had an extraordinary voice for a teaching lady. She said, "It's a tiny little thing." Tiny she was. And she said, "Right, dear." She said, "Get that chair." So I got the chair and I stood up. "No," she said, "don't you stand on it, dear, it's for me." And so she got up on the chair and she got a roll of newspaper. She said, "Open your mouth, dear." And I opened my mouth and she shoved the roll of newspaper in me gob. And she said, "Right, dear, go on, bite on that." And I bit. And she looked at the bite and she said, "Oh, no. Oh, no, dear. No, no, no. Oh, no, you've got a deformed mouth, dear." She said, "You'd never be any good in the theatre." She said, "You can't even speak properly." She said, "You lisp." She said, "I do. My tongue is far too big for my teeth. My tongue goes through my teeth when I say a letter S. Your tongue goes behind your teeth, but mine didn't." And so she said, "Oh, no, dear, no future in the theatre." And so that I left. I thought, that's it. I wasn't in the theatre long. Just long enough to stand up on a chair and have a roll of newspaper shoved in my face. So I said, "All right, well, I have to go somewhere else. I'll go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art." "Oh, I thought I'll get in there." "Yeah, sure I will." Mark you, my father was a governor, so I did stand a little chance. So I went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I hadn't been there more than two terms before I was sent for by the principal, Sir Kenneth Barnes. And he said, "I'm going to fire you. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "I have been speaking to your Greek teacher, Mrs. Wheeler, and she tells me that you have refused to be a wind." I said, "Well, yes, it's perfectly true. I have refused to be a wind. I mean, it's pretty silly, my father paying all this money for my education in the theatre, and now all I've got to do is go, ooh, ooh." "That's what you do as a Greek wind. Ooh, hundreds of you lining the side going, ooh." And I said, "No, I don't want to be a Greek wind. I want to be an actor." And he said, "You'll be a wind and like it." And I said, "No, I'm sorry." And he said, "Very well. You will leave at the end of this term."
Son, I thought I didn't last there long.
I did a play at the end of that term. In that play, as all students, you know, you play more than one part. I played the part of the man who was murdered in the first act, and I played the part of the detective who found out who murdered me in the last. I had great makeup. Her hair parted in the middle, a little tash and a monocle for the first character, and then the detective, you know, the dirty old raincoat and the battered hat and everything. And I was really rather proud of myself. And there were only two very small parts. But when it was over, Kenneth Barnes said to Noel Coward, who was the guest of honour, that he said, was there... Did you find any talent? Were you impressed? And Noel Coward says, very interesting, very, very good performance by a man who played the part of the man who was murdered in the first act. And I particularly liked the part of the detective who found out who murdered him at the last. Well, having played both parts, I was naturally very thrilled, and so I leapt forward and gave him a kiss, and very dangerous thing to do. But as he was a sort of guru of mine, a sort of godfather of mine, a great friend of my dad's, it was all right, and he was a great influence on my life in the theatre from then on, and I actually had the joy of working with him. Amazing wit, that lovely story about Noel Coward when he was watching the coronation, and it was a terrible day in the coronation, you may remember, some of you. It was pouring with rain, and the Queen wanted to be in the open carriage, and she couldn't, because she'd been soaked. And everybody would have been soaked, so they were all in the carriages sort of doing this, you know, through the windows, and all the crowd was sitting out in the rain. It was awful. It was a heartbreaking day. But Noel Coward was sitting in a grandstand, covered, and quite dry. And all the carriages went by, and when he and his friend were looking and saying, very good, very boring. And suddenly an open carriage went by with a lady in it, a vast lady, Queen Salotti of Tonga. And she'd melted. All the rain had melted her, and her hat hung down, like spaniel's ears. And sitting opposite to her was a little man in a top hat and a morning coat, and he'd melted too. But she was beaming and smiling all over her face, and she was waving to everybody, and the crowd went mad. They thought, what a marvellous woman. And so this man, he didn't know who she was, this friend of Noel Coward's, and he said, Noel, extraordinary woman, who on earth is that? And he said, oh, don't you know, my dear boy, that's the Queen of Tonga. He said, isn't she marvellous? Who's the little man sitting opposite to her? Noel Coward said, her lunch. I then joined a thing called the Arts League of Service Travelling Theatre, which was a bus with all the scenery on the top of the bus and all the actors and actresses on the bottom of the bus. And we did a programme of 150 items, and they were able to choose 10 items wherever we went, a different place every single night. They chose 10 items, but two had to be extracts and the classics. And we stayed with the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker. You never knew who we were going to stay with. It was wonderful. And I learnt an enormous amount. It was directed by Donald Wolfit, the last tour. Great, great actor. Wonderful story about Donald Wolfit. He'd been touring, as he did all the time. They said Laurence Olivier was a tour de force, and Donald Wolfit was forced to tour. But he was a wonderful actor, with best Lear in the business, I think. One day he was playing up in the north, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your magnificent reception of the piece tonight. Next week, we will be performing the Bard's Hamlet. I shall be playing the part of the prince, and my wife, Rosalind Iden, will be playing the part of the queen. And as he said that, a voice from the back of the gallery said, you what's a friggin' old tart! Nobody had ever heard anything like that before, never. They were thunderstruck. And Donald Wolfit, without pause, looked up and said, nevertheless. Wouldn't you love to have said something like that? I think that's wonderful. Nevertheless, I joined Brighton Repertory Company, where I was paid the grand sum of £3.10 per week. I lived in digs. They cost me 30 shillings, £1.10, and I had three meals a day. And on Sundays, the lady, Madame Penisson's lover, was the chief chef from Frascati's restaurant in London. And he came down on the last train, and we used to go to catch him. And then he had a big basket filled with smoked salmon and
and caviar and half bottles of claret and duck and... Oh, the most beautiful food ever. And we used to tow this thing back to number 13 Victoria Street, and on Sundays we'd have a great nosh. And my parents used to say, why don't you ever come home the weekends? I said, are you mad? With all that wonderful food? No way. This is where I learnt my love of good food and wine from the Penissons. 30 bob it cost me to live like that. Wonderful. We did twice nightly, twice weekly with matinees. Let me explain what that is. We did two plays a week, not one play a week, two plays a week. We rehearsed Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and we put the play on the Thursday. So you did Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, one play, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, another play. But of course we did twice nightly. You did 6 o'clock and 8:30 performances, and you did a matinee on a Wednesday and a matinee on a Saturday. So you had Monday morning, Monday afternoon, and two performances. Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon, two performances. Wednesday morning, a matinee, and two performances. On a Thursday, you had to put on the play you'd been rehearsing the week before. That was not easy. Not easy. You had to hypnotize yourself in order to learn the lines. And we did. We used to get a sheet of black card and put a pinhole in it with a candle. And you looked at it. And when it opened up, that was when your subconscious mind was opening. And then it would close. And you'd concentrate like mad on that page. And when you woke up about 20 minutes later, you knew that page pretty well. It was like an extraordinary photograph on your brain. This was fine as long as somebody gave you the right cue. If they gave you the wrong cue, you looked at this blank page, you said, what the bloody hell did he say there? It's got nothing whatsoever to do with it. You get confused with all sorts of things. We were doing a play called Love from a Stranger, and I played the gardener. And I had a green baize apron, and I had a spade beard, and a terrible gnarled face, and an old battered hat, and a corncob pipe. And I rushed down onto the stage, and the head of the company said, hello, and what are you supposed to be? And I said, I'm the gardener in Love from a Stranger. He said, are you? Well, we're playing Candida, you are the vicar, and you're supposed to be on the stage now. Oh, my God. Quickly rubbed the makeup into the face, tore the beard off, put the head round the corner of the door, saying, I'm terribly sorry to keep you waiting. I've been doing a little gardening, having a bit of trouble with the boll weevil. Would you take some tea? And then a poor little stage manager girl will come in and say, tea, madam? Milk and sugar? Would you like a biscuit? And anything to keep things going while I was up in the dressing room going mad, you know, trying to get the right makeup on. But this is the thing you had to do when you were in repertory companies like that. In the interval one day, I went up on top and there was a very sallow-skinned, little, wizened gentleman. He looked rather sick and I said, can I get you a cup of coffee? He said, oh, thank you so much. And I gave him a cup of coffee and he had a companion that was always with him. A very unfriendly chap he was. And this little man and I became great friends, and every single day I'd go out and make him a cup of coffee and take him one, and we'd sit and we'd talk about all sorts of things. He was very interested in the theatre. He didn't tell me anything about himself. And I didn't know who he was, but I became very fond of him. And then one day he disappeared. I couldn't find him. He didn't appear at all. And 3 or 4 days later, I opened my newspaper, and there on the front page was a picture. And it said, yesterday, His Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie took luncheon with King George. And there was a photograph of my little friend who sat on the end of the pier having cups of coffee with me. And he'd never, ever said that he was a king. And it was a terribly sad thing that I was never able to see him again, because unfortunately, you know, he came to a very sad end. Dear little man. I went to Jersey Repertory Company with Val Blanchard, who was the, eventually became MacDonald Hobley. Remember? And Peter Glenville, Sean Glenville's son, and Dorothy Ward's son, playing the leading man. I, fooling about, came in through the door as the vicar, and I said, oh, here, this is for you, and I pressed a fresh egg into his hand. Terribly funny. The audience thought it was hysterical. Wonderfully funny. He didn't think it was at all funny. And so he wrote a letter to the head of the company, J. Baxter Somerville, and said that he wasn't going to tolerate this raving idiot any longer. Unfortunately, J. Baxter Somerville came over the next day to see what I was up to, and he landed on the beach at Bully Bay in an aeroplane, so there was no airstrip in Jersey in those days. And he came to see the show, and at that precise minute, I'd done something even worse. We were doing a play with Lord Peter Wimsey, and Lord Peter Wimsey was explaining how the murder was done, which was the murderer had taken a brass pot with an aspidestra in it, had pulled it back on its chain and fixed it, and then, when the man that he was killing had gone up the stairs, he cut the wire, and the pot went smack and crushed the skull of the poor man who was murdered. And so he made this up by putting a pot of aspidestras on one of those China Victorian things. He said, that's the poor victim. And he took the weight back. And he said, and now I will show you how it was done. And he cut the rope and it went whoop, whoop, whoop. It's about that much away. Whoop, whoop. And the audience were hysterical. I was hysterical because I had shifted the dead up there about 6 inches, you see. Well, what a laugh. Until J. Baxter Somerville came round afterwards and said, very, very funny, Bertie, very funny. You're out. And I was duly fired. Amazing thing, though, about that was that I was the first naval officer into Jersey after it had been recaptured from the Germans. And I went to the Springfield Theatre just to take a look around the second day after we had taken over Jersey again. And I went in, and there were a lot of German prisoners of war about. There was one line only of flour bags. And I said, move that lot, because that's where the scene bay was behind. And they moved it. And I went in through the door, and there was this scene bay filled with all the props and the furniture and the scenery and everything of J. Baxter Somerville. Now, the Germans had been there, and they had no fuel at all. They burnt everything. They cut practically every tree down. But they never knew who that was, because they covered it up with sacks of grain, and they were down to the last line. And I'd managed to save it. So I rang up J.B. and I said, J.B., Pertwee. He said, oh, yes. And I said, do you want to give me a job after the war? He said, no. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, would you like to know something good? And he said, yes. And I said, all your scenery in Jersey is perfect. It's all there. I've seen it all. It was protected by a line of grain sacks. He said, was it? Do you want a job after the war? I never took him up on it because better things happened, I'm glad to say. I was walking down the street one day when I ran into an actor called John Salew, and John Salew said, you speak West Country, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, nip up to this studio in Bond Street. He said, go there. And he said, no, when you're in there, just say that I'm terribly sorry, I can't turn up today because I'm filming at Pinewood, and I've sent you instead. And so I went up, and the producer was furious. He said, what the hell's he talking about? Who the hell does he think he is? He said, I don't just get people off the street. I said, no, as a matter of fact, I said, I am known to the son of the man who owns the company, and I can do the voice. He said, you can? I said, yes. He said, go on, do it. And so luckily, it was a West Country farmer. Right, I said, that's no problem at all. It was a show called Marmaduke Brown, with Ernest Clarke played the lead, played Marmaduke Brown. So I did it, and they said, yeah, that's all right. That's not bad at all. He said, you got the job. And so I did it, and I played the gardener in Marmaduke Brown. I rushed back home, and I phoned my agent, and I said, Morris? He said, yes. And I said, I've got good news. He said, oh, yes. And I said, John Salew, I met in the street. He said, yes, I know. And I said, and he sent me there, and I've got the job. He said, yes, I know. And I said, well, what else do you know? He said, I know that you've got every other job Mr. Salew does there. I said, what do you mean? He said, you're doing Mr. Reader, you're doing Stella Dallas, you're doing Young Widow Jones, you're doing all of them. That could make 25 programs a week, and you're paid 2 guineas a program. You're going to make a lot of money, young man. And I said, well, you don't sound very happy about this. He said, I'm not. And I said, why? He said, I handle John Salew as well. And that was unfortunate, but I didn't care. And I worked on Radio Luxembourg more or less up to the start of the war. I was in a play called To Kill a Cat. Unfortunately, the producer was of a certain persuasion, which I wasn't, so he touched me up, and I said, don't do that. I said, because if you do, I'll knock you into the orchestra pit. And he did it again, and I knocked him into the orchestra pit. Not a good idea when you're starting off in the theatre. Not a good idea at all. He was injured, and so I was fired. I was expelled once again. And so I thought, well, what else can I do? I'll join the services. The war had started. And so I said, what am I going to join? I'm not going to join the Air Force. I'm too frightened to join the Air Force. How anybody could ever do what pilots did, I never know. The bravery of people getting into a plane and going out and flying over enemy territory night after night. Amazing courage. I wasn't going to join the Army because I'd had nightmares about trenches and rats and bayonets and things. Because I was born in 1919, just after the First World War, and so I thought, no, not for me. I'll join the Navy. Yes, because you're a long way away from the enemy. If you go into action, you're a long way away, and they might miss. And also, the food isn't bad. And it wasn't, because when I was in the Navy, I was actually in action in the North Sea. And we were in action, fighting a war, and somebody said, Righto, Pee-wee, grub's up, and I dropped what I was doing and went down and had a hot meal. You didn't get that in the Army or the Air Force. And that's firing a gun that's almost red hot, you know. Righto, Pee-wee, grub's up, wonderful. And also, of course, not to forget, all the nice girls love a sailor. I forgot that I was desperately seasick, even on the Round Pond. I was terribly seasick. I was in submarines to begin the war.
That's a very uncomfortable movement. And I was a wireless operator in a tiny caboose, and I'm 6'2½. And every time the captain said, "Pertwee," I said, "Sir," and I banged my head on every bulkhead, and I went round the piece of sticking plaster on my forehead. And the captain said, "Good God, that wound of yours is taking a long time to heal, isn't it?" I said, "I haven't got a wound," says it. "And why are you wearing that sticking plaster?" I said, "So I won't get one, sir." And he said, "Nevertheless, take that sticking plaster off. I'll get you transferred." And so they took me out of submarines, and they put me into battle cruisers, and they put me into a ship called HMS Hood. And HMS Hood was the biggest battle cruiser in the British fleet. It did 42 knots. It weighed 43,000 tons. It had a complement of 1,768 men. And I was in Russian convoys. And believe me, that was tough. It was very cold. It wasn't as tough as people in hard-lying ships like destroyers and things like that. But there wasn't even room for me to sling my hammock. I used to sleep on a bench, sideways, with my head on a sailor's cap. But I never fell off. I could balance myself on it and going through an amazing sea. Seas, I promise you, that were 85 feet high. And that's no lie. And when you get 42,000 tons going whap, and you didn't go over the top, you went into the middle, and then it came out the other end, and then down on the sea, and spray would shoot over the ship. And I was in the spotting top. I was a spotter up in the spotting top, covered in about 18 overcoats and about 7 hats and balaclava helmets. And when it went down like that and the spray went, I used to duck down quick because the water froze instantly and turned itself into icicles. And can you imagine a more ridiculous way of dying than being stabbed to death by an icicle? That's what would have happened, believe me. And we were up in Russian convoys, and then the Wolfpack submarines came out because the spotting aeroplanes used to come round and round the Focke-Wulfs, go round and round and round. And our gunnery officer had a great sense of humour. And he was looking up at this aeroplane once we were off Murmansk, and Archangel, and the plane was going round and round and round. And he said, "Hey, you up there, Fritz, for God's sake, go round the other way, boy, you're making us dizzy." And we thought, that's a very funny man. And back came an answer from the German pilot, said, "Certainly, anything to oblige the British," and did. You would not believe it. In the early days, there was a certain sense of humour. They soon forgot all about the sense of humour after the war had been on a couple of years. On another occasion, I remember we were firing at a Focke-Wulf, and it was ridiculous because the plane was there and we didn't get up that high, but going boom, 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 boom. Again, our signals officer sent up this message and said to the pilot, "Hey, you up there, how's that?" And back came the answer from the German pilot, "Not out." Now, unfortunately, as you all probably know, the Hood came unstuck. She sailed into action against the Bismarck, the biggest battleship in the world, and the fastest, and the Hood was quick, but she'd had her magazine hatch covers made into very thin ones and make her light enough to catch the Bismarck, because she was quick. It was an unhappy ship because we never believed that it would take much of a whack, that it would probably explode. And what happened as we were closing in, I was a CW candidate, and which meant that I was an officer candidate. My captain had sent for me and said, "Tell me about Radio Luxembourg." And I said, "Oh, do you really want to know?" So he said, "Yes, I've always wanted to know. How do you do it?" And I told him for 20 minutes. He said, "Right, okay, that's lovely." I said, "Excuse me, what was that all about?" He said, "Oh, you just passed a CW candidates course thing. You know, you just, that's your interview." I said, "Oh, thank you very much indeed, sir. Does that mean I can go?" And he said, "Yes, you can go." I didn't realise that when he said you can go, that I was going to be over the side of that ship. And I was down over grappling ropes, and I went down the netting, and I went into a drifter, and I was taken off to a ship called the Dunluce Castle, back at Scapa Flow. And the Hood just sailed on, and it got the first shell into the Bismarck. Bismarck then got the range of Hood, and the awful thing was, the very first shell hit the daylight workshop flat underneath the bridge, and all the upper guns' crews had all closed up in that, because they weren't going to be used, the high-angle guns. And the whole lot were killed, and practically everybody was killed on the bridge as well. One 16-inch shell right in the middle. The man in the spotting top where I used to work, he was a signalman, Signalman Briggs, and he was blown out, and he was blown, presumably, into the sea. And one midshipman, Midshipman Dundas, he went like this, and he went through the window of the bridge and slid across the deck and into the sea, as far as he remembers. He doesn't remember very much about it. Now, there was one man on the upper gun deck, leading seaman, Tilburn. He was the killick of my mess.
And he was sitting with two mates behind a UP projectile locker, sitting there. And the next salvo landed between the stacks, right in the middle, and went, and it blew his two friends to pieces either side of him and killed them instantly. And he wasn't scratched, which is an extraordinary thing a blast does. So he jumped from the upper gun deck, which is about as high as those lights, right down onto the forecastle. And he tore off one sea boot. And at that precise minute, the third salvo landed forward of X turret, A, B, X, Y. And it went straight down through two wooden decks, hit the armored deck, exploded. And because of these thin hatch covers, they just blew in and the blast went down, hit the magazine, and whoosh, the ship exploded. It went down in 9.5 seconds. 1,768 men died and three survived, leading Seaman Tilburn, the midshipman Dundas and Sigelman Briggs. This was a dreadful thing, and of course I was absolutely heartbroken about this because I lost all my friends and my mates, and it was a dreadful thing to happen. And when I got back, all the letters from my parents had been returned saying the addressee of this envelope is missing, presumed killed. And so therefore, when I arrived in the flat and opened the door and said, "Hi, Dad," he said, "Oh, no." My father's sense of humour. Well, we went then from then on survivor's leave, and I went down to Portsmouth Barracks as a CW candidate. And while I was at the CW candidate, I met up with a man called Chief Petty Officer Branch, who's to say, "Righto, let's rock, Mr. Bell." And it was one of these people that everybody was frightened of. And he said, "Righto, come on in, Pee-wee, come here." "My God," he said, "get your bloody hair cut. You look like a bleeding chrysanthemum." And I corpsed, and I started to laugh. He said, "What are you laughing at?" And I said, "But you, sir." He said, what are you laughing at me for? I'm not supposed to be funny." I said, "Well, you are, sir. You're very funny." He said, "You're supposed to be frightened of me." And I said, "Well, I'm not, sir." He said, "Well, try, for Christ's sake." He said, "Right, get all these men and march about the end of the parade ground and turn them about." So I said, "Right, squad, by the lift, quick, march." And off they went. And when they were gone about the length of this theatre, I said, "Squad, oh!" He said, "Well, what you wait for it, I'll tell you when." And I said, "But can I?" He said, "I'll tell you when." And so they were disappearing, almost out of sight. And I said, "Squad!" He said, "Not yet. I'll tell you when." Oh, my God. And I really clutched the gluteals and said, "Squad, about turn!" Now, the men at the back heard me. They turned about. The ones in the middle thought I said right turn, and they went that way. The ones on the left went that way, and the ones in the front heard nothing, and they went straight on. "Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear." He said, "Come on, get them back together, lad." And so I said, "Squad, hello, turn!" And this they all heard, and they all turned, and... And Chief Petty Officer Branch said, "Yes. Well, now I know what they mean when they say Marines will advance in columns of fours and Matlows in friggin' great heaps." I love that man. Weeks later, I was in G Block in Portsmouth Barracks and I was fire watching, and an incendiary bomb came through the roof, and I put a sandbag on the top and I jumped on it to put it out, which is very stupid because it went through the ceiling into the hammocks and started a raging inferno. And there were six of us up there and we were going to be barbecued. And so I said, "Right, everybody out, lads." And they all went down the ladder and I was the last out. And I looked to see if there were any more, and there weren't. So I came down the ladder. At that precise minute, the Germans dropped a landmine on a parachute at the end of the building. It blew up the regulating petty officer's block. It killed many RPOs. It blew the end of our building off. The blast came in, hit the wall, sucked me out, which blast does extraordinary things, and I went backwards through this mess room with the girders going over my head, and I went out of the hole at the end of the building and landed, bang, in the middle of all the rubble of the exploded and the blown-up building. Well, I mean, I was in a terrible state. I was covered in blood, I was black, I was deaf, and when the men came round with the paddy wagons and with the stretchers, and they found me on the top of the building, obviously I was dead. So they picked me up and they put me on the stretcher and they took me over to the officers' mess and they took me into the mortuary. And the mortuary was the larder. They thought, what a good idea, you know, nice marble slabs, very good, but put all the dead in there. And so they put me on a slab in the larder of the officers' mess. I'd never been in the officers' mess before.
And there I was on the larder, and I woke up, and there was an arm hanging above me. And I pulled the arm, I said, and the body went, and fell on the floor. He was dead. And I called, I said, hey, but wait, and the door opened, and a white-faced sick birth attendant came out and said, oh, gosh. I said, here, this man's dead. He said, blimey, mate, I thought you friggin' well was. And so they picked me up, and they took me back to Haslar Hospital. And when I was in Haslar Hospital, an angel of mercy flew down from the heavens. And she had a red cross on her breast, and she flew down, and she said, I went, and she said, and I went, and so she wrote it on a piece of paper, what is your name? And I said, Pertwee. And she went, oh, no! Burst into tears was a girlfriend of mine. I'd been with her about 4 weeks before in London. We'd been out to dinner, and she was a VAD, and she just started, and the very first patient that she had to look after was me, a bloody conical mass, with a thing called a hematoma on my head, and you know, that. And so she said, may I look after Pertwee, doctor? And he said, yes, of course you can, and she looked after me. That's right, yes, she really looked after me. Which was wonderful, to be in a hospital and have somebody really look after you. And so I was sort of happy about that. And when I came out, I was ready for my CW candidates course, and I was then going to be an officer at sea, I thought. But unfortunately, I couldn't add. I can't work without a calculator or fingers and toes. And so when the officer at King Alfred said, right, you all understand the theorem of Pythagoras, I suppose? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, well, I haven't got time to teach you. He said, sit at the back, shut up, and be neat. Right, I said. So when we had the exam papers, I was terribly neat. I drew a picture of a lovely galleon, and I got 3 marks for neatness, but nothing for navigation. So I said, please, I said, don't send me back to sea, because you know, I'll die. I can't be any longer at sea. I've done my sea time, surely. There must be something I can do as an officer. And so the captain, Captain Pelly, said, yeah, I suppose, all right, so we'll put you in special branch. And he put me in special branch, which you had special jobs, rather strange jobs. A French officer suddenly appeared, and I heard him talking to my divisional officer, and he said, where is he? And he said, over there. And he came over and said, you Pertwee? And I said, yes. He said, alors, vous parlez français, naturellement. I said, eh? What? Never volunteer for anything, see. Nothing to do with French. Ooh, no, you know, with D-Day. No, keep well away from that, no. Do something in Scotland. No, France, no. And I said, no, je ne parle pas, just très mal. He said, but in your papers, it says that you are a French family, that you naturally, you speak French. And he said, I said, no, I used to, but I don't anymore. So he said, that's very... He said, that's very, very strange. I will talk to you later. I thought, I'm in the dead trouble here. And he went up and he spoke to a fellow called Rankin. And he said, you are Rankin? And he said, yes, sir. He said, do you parle français? He said, oui, je parle français. Oui, pas très bon, mais je parle. I went, oh, my God. And he said, follow me, Rankin. And he went into the office. And he came out a few minutes later. And I rushed up to him and I said, Tony, right, come on, tell me, what was the job? He said, resident naval officer in Tahiti. Could you believe it? Years later, I was in Tahiti, and I stayed there for quite a time. And I got to know a fellow called Freddie Devenish, who was the British consul, and he'd been there in the Navy during the war. And I said to him one day, Freddie, did you by any chance know a fellow called Tony Rankin? And he turned round to one of the girls sitting alongside me and said, ah, you know what old Pertwee wants to know? He wants to know if we know old Boom Boom Rankin. So thank you very much indeed, sir. Exactly what I want to hear. I think that the time has come for you to change your library books, to have a cup of coffee, and let me move around a little. I'm sedentary because I had a back operation a few months ago, and sitting in a bar stool for an hour or two does tend to paralyze me. So I'm going for a cross-country run for a few minutes. So if you'll bear with me, I'll see you in a few minutes. Thank you so much for your time.